time out. Anybody heard that expression? Time out. Time out is a child discipline technique that's often recommended by pediatric doctors and child psychologists as an alternative to spanking. You see, when a child misbehaves, you isolate him for a period of time. He calms down. You calm down. The child can think about what he or she has done. The parent can formulate a plan for discipline. I have no problems at all with time out. There's no question that it's biblical. In fact, the Bible teaches both spanking and time out. For 2 Kings closes with the sacking of Jerusalem and the burning of its walls and its temple. Hey, the Jews got a good spanking. I don't think anyone would argue that. God gave them a good spanking. But then God placed them in time out for 70 years. The Babylonians were carted off to a foreign land. And during their time out in Babylon, they got to think. During those 70 years, they cultivated a hatred for idolatry as they saw the idolatry around them. A longing for God was rekindled in their hearts. God was preparing these Jews for a brand new start. You know, it's been said, sometimes you don't appreciate what you've got until it's lost. This was the case with Judah before God's judgment and their exile. Their new start became a reality when the Babylonians fell to the Persians in 536 BC. The Persian king Cyrus, he issued a decree allowing all of the Jews to return home and to rebuild their temple. But this return was tough. The city was in rubble. The land was barren. The Jews who came home literally had to start over. One of the exiles who returned to Jerusalem was a priest by the name of Ezra. And Ezra tried to encourage his fellow Jews by writing a chronicle of their history. He highlighted how God had worked in their past and how his plan for them wasn't finished. Ezra got the Jews excited about their future by reminding them of their glorious past. You'll notice immediately that Chronicles repeats much of the same material that we went over in 2 Samuel and in 1 and 2 Kings, but from a different slant. For the most part, 1 and 2 Chronicles ignores the northern kingdom of Israel and spotlights exclusively Judah and the south. 1 and 2 Kings sort of flip-flop back and forth. You remember, we got confused at times. You know, which Azariah are we talking about here? It would flip-flop back and forth between the two neighbors. But Chronicles deals exclusively, practically exclusively, with Judah and with the kings of the Davidic dynasty. 1 and 2 Chronicles were penned to encourage a defeated and deflated people to start over. And you know, we too would do well to chronicle the wonderful ways that God has intervened in our lives. I loved Pastor Nick's testimony this morning. We all have a testimony. And we should all be able to recount the miracles God has done in our lives. So often we forget God's work, especially those little daily miracles that He does. We too are wise to keep a chronicle. We might call it a journal, to remind ourselves of God's faithfulness toward us. Well, 1 Chronicles, it begins with the genealogy of the tribe of Judah. It's important before a person can decide what to do, they need to know who they are. That's the importance of this genealogy. The sequence is always identity shapes attitude, then attitude shapes action. Everything, though, starts with identity. Proverbs 23, verse 7 says it this way, "For as a man thinks in his heart, so is he. How you see yourself will determine how you live your life." If you see yourself in Christ as a saved and sealed child of God, my friend, you'll live like one. But if you see yourself in some kind of limbo, or apart from God, or wandering, you know, in between God and the world, you'll drift yourself. You won't have solid footings and solid foundations. I've got an interesting picture. It's a cat looking at itself in the mirror, but the image reflected back off of the mirror is that of a lion. And the caption reads, "What matters most is how you see yourself." That picture is not lying. It's true. What matters most is how you see yourself. Remember, the symbol of the tribe of Judah was what? It was a lion. These defeated and deflated Jews, their return to the land, you know, was being sabotaged because they felt like a kitty cat. They felt defeated. They felt, you know, how could God ever use us after what we've done? But in God's eyes, they were still a lion. Ezra begins with a genealogy because he wants to remind God's people that lion-hearted blood still flowed through their veins. Hey, our own personal comebacks will often get derailed because we feel a little kittenish. When fear causes us to shrink from a challenge. But hey, if we're truly in Christ, if you are truly a child of God, my oh my, it's time you let the cat out of the bag. Hey, the lion of the tribe of Judah lives in you. And you need to live that way. You know, in America, the melting pot, these first nine chapters here might seem like nothing, maybe a bunch of boring begots. For some people, researching their genealogy, their genealogical records is a fun pastime. But in our country, your lineage really doesn't determine much. But not so with the Jews. Their genealogies were extremely significant. First of all, your genealogy was your link to the land. You remember Joshua divided the land among the families. A person's tribal identity was their title deed to where they could settle and where they could live. Second, in the case of the Levites, occupation was determined by pedigree. Only members of the tribe of Levi could serve as priests in the temple. And then third, the throne of Israel was determined by genealogy. The ultimate ruler of all the earth, the Messiah himself, was to be a descendant of David. Thus, the genealogy here in 1 Chronicles is important in tracing the lineage of Jesus and his right to rule. These were very important chronicles that the people of Judah needed to restart and reestablish their kingdom. Well, 1 Chronicles begins. Adam, Seth, Enosh, Canaan, Mahalalel, Jared, Enoch, Methuselah, Lamech, Noah, and his three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Did you know we just covered 1,500 years? From Adam down to Japheth, from creation to the flood, was 1,500 years. You remember, Adam lived 930 of those years. Evidently, conditions before the flood allowed people to live these long ages. That starts to change, though, with the family of Noah. Well, verses 5 through 28 traces the family of Noah. Noah's three sons and their descendants. Verses 5 through 7 list Japheth's sons. Gomer, not Gomer Pyle. His descendants settled in Mayberry. No. Gomer fathered the Germanic tribes. Magog, the Russian tribes. Madai, the Medes and the Persians. Yavin, the Greeks. Tubal, the Turks. Verses 8 through 6 tracks Ham's offspring. Cush apparently branched off into two families. Nimrod fathered the Babylonians, whereas Cush became associated with Ethiopia. Mizraim were the Egyptians. Put was Libya. And the Canaanites were the people who inhabited Israel before God gave the land to the Hebrews. Verses 17 through 28 speaks to the sons of Shem. Elam fathered the Persians. Ashur, the Assyrians, and Arphaxad was the ancestor of Abram and Israel. Noah's three sons fathered the three major people groups on the planet today. Japheth, trace his descendants, you'll see that he fathered the Caucasian races. Shem sired the Oriental groups, including the Hebrews, and the descendants of Ham migrated to Africa. Verse 19 to me is intriguing. It says, to Eber were born two sons. The name of one was Peleg, for in his days the earth was divided. That word Peleg means division. Scientists today hypothesize that the earth was at one time a single land mass. They even have a name for it. They call it Pangaea. I believe that after the global flood of Noah's day, massive runoffs and erosion and underwater explosions caused the continents to literally break apart and drift from one another. And this may be what Ezra makes mention of here. It occurred, he says, during the time of Peleg, the earth was divided, and of course this name means division. Before the flood, though, the earth was one supercontinent. You know, go home and just look at a globe. And just sort of look at the continents and look at a globe. And you can almost get the sense that they're puzzle pieces. And you can almost kind of put them back together and see how that at one time they perhaps were all connected. This could even explain how animals and people made it to the New World. They were here before the continents divided. Just some interesting information. Now, do you know the shortest verse in the Bible? Anybody know the shortest verse in the Bible? Jesus wept. John 11:35, Jesus wept. What a profound verse. Does anyone know the shortest verse in the Old Testament? It's not quite as profound. Anybody know the shortest verse in the Old Testament? Oh my, stump the panel. Well, here's a great trivia question. The shortest verse in the Old Testament, 1 Chronicles chapter 1, verse 25. Eber, Peleg, and Rhea. Not as profound, but just as short. Notice the name Eber. This is the root word for the word Hebrews, the name that was later given to the family of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, 1 Chronicles chapters 1, verse 1 through 29 takes us from Adam down to this man Abraham, about 4,000 years. The rest of chapter 1 focuses on the family of Abraham. Remember, his initial name, his original name was what? Abram. But God changed his name to Abraham, which means father of many nations. Not only were the Israelites descendants of Abraham, but so were many of the nations that were scattered across the Middle East. Ishmael and the Arabs, the Midianites and the Edomites, even the tribes of Sheba and Dedan, tribes of the Arabian Peninsula, these were all Abraham's descendants. Did you know that the Queen of Sheba and Solomon were distant relatives? They were both descendants of Abraham. Notice too, verse 44. Here's another interesting detail. Among the kings of Edom is a man named Jobab. Ring a bell? Jobab? It's possible, I think even probable, that this is the same man that the Bible calls Job. Chapter 2 begins with Abraham's 12 great-grandsons. Abraham begot Isaac. Isaac begot Jacob. Jacob, whose name was later changed to Israel, begot 12 sons. Verse 1. These were the sons of Israel: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Dan, Joseph, Benjamin. And you remember Joseph had two sons. Anybody remember? Ephraim and Manasseh. Then Benjamin, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. Ezra provides us the genealogy of each of these tribes and the boundaries of their territories. Verse 3 starts to list the family of Judah. Follow that genealogy down, if you will, to verse 12. And there you find a man named Jesse. Jesse had seven sons. And of course, the youngest of those seven sons was a shepherd boy by the name of David. And David became king over all Israel. We'll learn about that later. And heir to the promised Messiah. One of the other sons of Judah that gets special treatment in chapter 2 is Caleb. Remember Caleb? He was one of the 12 spies that Moses sent to scope out the land. 10 of the spies brought back a report of gloom and doom. Victory was impossible. There's giants in that land. Only Joshua and Caleb believed in God. And it was their positive assessment, an assessment that was laced with faith, that Israel could take the land, that if Israel just believed in God, God would give those giants to them. God would give those giants as plunder. It was Caleb and Joshua's great faith that caused the tribes of Israel to rise up and take the promised land. Well, verse 18 through 55 traces the genealogy of Caleb's family. Of course, it took them 40 years to believe Joshua and Caleb, but that's another detail. Chapters 3, 1 through 9 list David's immediate family. David had 7 wives, 19 sons, and 1 daughter. Now you know what he did with his spare time. We're told in verse 4, he reigned 7.5 years in Hebron over the tribe of Judah, and then 33 years in Jerusalem over a united kingdom of all 12 tribes. David's reign became Israel's golden age. Verse 5 of chapter 3 mentions the 4 sons born to David in Jerusalem by his wife Bathsheba, or another name, Bathsheba. Shimeah, Shobab, Nathan, and Solomon. It's interesting that you find nothing in the Chronicles about David's adultery with Bathsheba. It's silent on that point. It doesn't mention the death of the son that they sired, nor does it mention the moral decline that it caused within David's family. Amnon's rape of Tamar, the rebellion of Absalom, David's forced exodus from Jerusalem, even the coup attempt by Adonijah. All of those issues are conspicuously missing from Ezra's account of Judah's history. Only 2 of David's failures get mentioned in the Chronicles. The mistake that he makes when he brings the ark up to Jerusalem, we'll talk about that. And then the second mistake is his sin in ordering a census. Now, some people might accuse Ezra of a cover-up. Why only highlight David's good moments? Why not talk about those bad moments, those sinful times? But recall Ezra's purpose. Ezra is writing to encourage a terribly defeated people. The Jews didn't need to be reminded of their failures. They had spent 70 years in exile for the punishment of their sin. Hey, Ezra's readers needed a pick-me-up. They needed to focus on the positive, not the negative. And I think this is true of any person who's truly repentant. You know, some pastors think it's their duty to constantly remind people of how sinful and how sorry they are. I don't know about you, but I know how sinful and how sorry I am. So often I need encouragement to get my eyes off my failures and to focus my eyes on what Jesus has done for me. We need to see ourselves in Christ. Reminds me of Tommy and Sally. They had visited Grandma and Grandpa's house. They were walking around the barnyard one afternoon when Tommy decided to try out his slingshot. So he got that slingshot whipping above his head and he let that rock fly. And accidentally, that rock struck Grandma's favorite goose, got his goose. The goose fell over dead and Tommy, oh my, he was so upset. He wanted to try to keep it a secret, and so in a panic, he grabbed the goose and he stuck it in the woodpile, tried to cover up the whole thing. The only problem, though, is that Sally saw what had happened. That night after dinner, Grandma said, "Sally, let's wash the dishes." And that's when Sally sort of turned to Tommy and whispered, "Remember that goose?" She turned to Grandma and she said, "Grandma, tonight Tommy would like to do the dishes with you." Tommy said, "Yes, Grandma, I'd like to do the dishes." And so Tommy did the dishes. Well, later that night, Grandpa decided to go fishing. He said, "Tommy, why don't you come along?" Sally leaned over and said, "Remember that goose?" Tommy said, "Well, Grandpa, I'm sort of tired tonight. Why don't you take Sally with you?" And so Sally went fishing. Well, Tommy couldn't stand this. One night of this was enough. He couldn't stand living like this. And so the next morning, he went to Grandma and he confessed to his dastardly deed. That's when his grandma said, "Sweetheart, I was looking through the window when you killed that goose. And because I love you, I've already forgiven you. I was just waiting to see how long you'd let Sally make you her slave." This is the question God is asking some of us tonight. He loves us so much, and He's already forgiven us. He's just hoping that we'll wise up and stop letting the devil make us his slave. It's time for us to accept God's forgiveness and trust in God's forgiveness and believe we're forgiven because Jesus said so. Well, here's the good news I get out of this genealogy. The heir to David's throne, King Solomon, God's chosen successor, he was born to this adulterous Bathsheba. It was God's way of redeeming David's slide, his sinful slide. Yes, God hated their sin that night. And yes, it was costly to David. In fact, the son that was conceived on that adulterous night died shortly after his birth. But the glorious truth about God's forgiveness is that it lets us pick up at the point of our repentance and start over. And this is what Ezra is trying to stress to these post-exiled Jews, that you can start over after a Bathsheba or even after a Babylon. As a matter of fact, you can start over after anything that you repent of and that you confess. Never forget that our God is the God of another chance. Well, the latter half of chapter 3 is strategic because it traces the descendants of David through the sons of a man named Zerubbabel. You see his name in verse 19. This was the leader of the Jews who returned to Judah from Babylon. And here Ezra makes a vital link between the descendants of David before the exile and the Jews who returned after the exile. In other words, the 70 years that Judah had spent in Babylon had not interfered with the lineage of David and with God's promises to him. Chapters 4 through 7 list the genealogy of Israel's 12 tribes. And it starts with Judah. Let's pick it up in chapter 4, verse 5. Chapter 4, verse 5. Asher, the father of Tekoa, had two wives, Hela and Naara. Naara bore him Azuzam, Hefer, Tamini, and Hashatari. Sounds like a video game. These were the sons of Naara. The sons of Hela was Zareth, Zohar, and Ethnan, and Kaz. Kaz, who was somebody's cuz, begat Anub, Zobibah, and the families of Aharhel, the son of Haram. And then verse 9. Now Jabez was more honorable than his brothers, and his mother called his name Jabez, saying, "Because I bore him in pain." And Jabez called on the God of Israel, saying, "Oh, that you would bless me indeed and enlarge my territory, that your hand would be with me and that you would keep me from evil, that I may not cause pain." So God granted him what he requested. Now, I love this. Ezra is listing hundreds of personal names. And there are people behind these names. Real lives, families, jobs, hobbies, careers. There are people behind these names. And he's listing these hundreds of names, name after name after name. And he chooses to give one man special mention. And for what reason? What great deed did Jabez do to get singled out from the crowd? Catch this. He prayed. That's all he did. That's why he got special mention. He bothered to pray. Jabez never built a temple, never killed a giant, never worked a miracle, but he gets extra ink in Scripture. He gets a special mention in the Word of God for no other reason than he prayed. We're told that Jabez called on the God of Israel. Hey, apparently the deeds of all of his brothers combined weren't nearly as noteworthy in God's eyes as the content of this man's prayer. Let me encourage you. Just take the time to pray. Well, this name Jabez, it means he causes pain. Maybe his mom had an extremely tough time in the labor and delivery. And when the doc asked, hey, what's his name? She thought he said, how's the pain? And she said, Jabez. Oh, he causes pain. One of my favorite songs is by Johnny Cash. It's entitled, A Boy Named Sue. You remember the song? Some gal would giggle and I'd get red. And some guy would laugh and I'd bust his head. I tell you, life ain't easy for a boy named Sue. And I, of all people, can relate. Because it ain't much better for a boy named Sandy. However, Jabez got his unusual name. He did, after he got his unusual name, he did all he could to live it down. Notice that. His prayer reflected a desire to be a blessing to folks rather than a source of pain. You know, there are a lot of people that have a handicap. They have a disability of some sort. Maybe it's your name. Maybe it's some other disability. But you can become bitter about it. You can use it as a crutch, or you can take the opposite attitude. You can say, I'm going to do all I can to be a blessing, not a pain. I'm going to do all I can to live down this disability and rise above it and be all that I can be and all that I was meant to be. This was Jabez's attitude. Verse 10 tells us how he prayed, oh, that you would bless me indeed. In other words, Lord, bless me a bunch. Mercy drops round me are falling, but oh, for the showers I plead. Ever sung that song? Did you know that you could ask God to bless you? I talked to a guy today at lunch. He told me he was in the habit of praying for other people, but he didn't like much asking God to bless him. Hey, I think you need to ask God to bless you. I think you can't really be a blessing to others until you've received God's blessing in your own life. I think Jabez understood that. And so he prayed, Lord, bless me a bunch. Bless me indeed. Pour out your blessing on me, Lord. I need your blessing in my life. He also prays, enlarge my territory. Jabez wanted his life to count for God in the greatest way possible. And so he asked God for more influence, more responsibility. Enlarge my territory that I can make a bigger impact for you and that your hand would be with me. Jabez understood that he wouldn't go far on his own resources, that he was limited by his own capabilities, and thus he prays for God's strong hand to be upon him, and that you would keep me from evil. In other words, Lord, protect me, and protect me from myself. How often I pray that prayer. Lord, protect me from my own weaknesses. Don't let me succumb, Lord, to the evil around me in my attempts to do good. Lord, protect me, keep me from evil. Here's what Jabez prays. He says, Lord, bless me a bunch. Expand my borders. Fill me with your spiritual power. Protect me from evil, that I may not cause pain. And notice what Ezra says. So God granted him what he requested. Now here's a prayer you can pray, and you can be assured that God will answer it because he's answered it before. You can pray the prayer of Jabez, and God will answer it for you just as he answered it for Jabez. It's a wonderful line. So God granted him what he had requested. Well, verse 11 picks back up with the brothers of Judah and Jabez. Chelub, the brother of Juha, begot Mehir, who was the father of Eshdan. And on it goes. Here's a trivia question. What verse in the Bible contains every letter of the alphabet except the letter X? What verse in the Bible contains every letter of the alphabet except the letter X? The answer? 1 Chronicles chapter 4, verse 10. And I'm going to lose you for the next few minutes while you check it out for yourself, so we'll just do it all together. You ready? I'm going to go through the letters of the alphabet, and when I hit a letter, you just throw up your hand if you see it in the verse. Ready? A, B, C, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q, R, S, T, U, V, W. See a W? Yeah, it's in there. W. Y. And Z. Jabez. Z. Got it? There's no X. 1 Chronicles chapter 4, verse 10. You're going to be a hit at the next trivia night. I'm telling you. You got some ammo. Look at verse 22. Also, Joachim, the men of Chozeba, and Joash, Zeraph, who ruled in Moab, and Shushabilahim, now the records are ancient. Isn't that interesting? The records are ancient. First Chronicles became the national archives. There's a picture of our national archives. But First Chronicles, chapters 1 through 9, became the national archives of the nation Israel. As we go through these chapters, you know, we're just sort of picking and gleaning and finding nuggets here and there. But understand, Ezra provided Israel a vital service here by documenting these genealogies. These were extremely important to the Hebrews. Verse 24 begins the genealogy of the sons of Simeon. Chapter 5 contains the genealogies of the three tribes that took their inheritance east of the Jordan River. Verses 1 through 10, the tribe of Reuben. Verses 11 through 22, the tribe of Gad. And verses 23 through 26, half the tribe of Manasseh. Now look at what's said of the 2.5 tribes that settled east of the Jordan. The sons of Reuben, the Gadites, and the half the tribe of Manasseh had 44,760 valiant men. Men able to bear shield and sword, to shoot with the bow, and skillful in war, who went to war. They made war with the Hagrites, the Jetur, Naphish, and Nodab. And they were helped against them, and the Hagrites were delivered into their hand, and all who were with them, for they cried out to God in the battle. He heeded their prayer, because they put their trust in Him. Then they took away their livestock, 50,000 of their camels, 250,000 of their sheep, and 2,000 of their donkeys, also 100,000 of their men, for many fell dead because the war was God's. Now notice that. Many fell dead because the war was God's, and they dwelt in their place until the captivity. Now, if you're a pacifist tonight, that might cause you to squirm. Many fell dead because the war was God's. And here to me is evidence for what we call righteous war. There are some military campaigns that are not only necessary, they are within the will of God. In fact, they are ordained by God. There are battles, there are wars where men fall dead that God wants fought. I don't know how you work that into your thinking, how you work that into your philosophy, but that's scriptural, that's biblical. Notice again, this war was God's. Well, the rest of 1 Chronicles 5 describes how that the tribes east of the Jordan fell into idolatry and were destroyed by the Assyrians, by Tiglath-Pileser and his marauding bands. Chapter 6 begins The sons of Levi were Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. These were the three divisions of priests that made up the tribe of Levi. And just for your review, do you remember each of these priestly families' responsibilities? There were three F's. Oh my. Yeah, well, you're getting there. The Kohathites, they carried the tabernacle furniture, right? The Ark of the Covenant, the table of incense, table of showbread, and so forth. The Gershonites, they carried the fabric of the tabernacle. And then the Merariites, they carried the frame, the poles, the sockets, and the boards, and so forth, of the tabernacle. So the Kohathites carried the tabernacle furniture. Gershon carried the tabernacle fabrics. Merari carried the tabernacle frame. When you get to heaven, there will be a quiz. Verse 31 begins with an interesting genealogy. Now these are the men whom David appointed over the service of song in the house of the Lord after the ark came to rest. They were ministering with music before the dwelling place of the tabernacle of meeting until Solomon had built the house of the Lord in Jerusalem, and they served in their office according to their order. And these are the sons who ministered with their sons. Of the sons of the Kohathites, Heman the singer was the first one. Then drop down to verse 39. And his brother Asaph, who stood at his right hand. And then move down to verse 44. Their brethren, the sons of Merari, on the left hand, were Ethan. Now these verses record the genealogy of the three priestly divisions established by David to do music in the house of God. The sons of Heman. And by the way, you can read one of Heman's songs. Psalm 88 was written by Heman. The sons of Asaph. And Asaph, you can read several of his songs. He wrote 12 of the 150 Hebrew Psalms. And then the sons of Ethan, who was responsible for authoring Psalm 89. And you know, what a great job to get. These guys were paid just to hang out in the temple and just fill the place with praise. Anybody want that job? We all do. Hey, David knew the priority of praise and of worship. He knew that God inhabits the praises of his people. Thus, David filled the tabernacle, he filled the temple daily with praise and with worship. Verse 49. But Aaron and his sons offered sacrifices on the altar of burnt offering and on the altar of incense for all the work of the most holy place and to make atonement for Israel according to all that Moses, the servant of God, had commanded. Aaron was Israel's first high priest. His sons would succeed him. Now these are the sons of Aaron, Eleazar his son, Phinehas his son, Abishua his son, Bukai his son, Uzi his son, he carried a machine gun by the way, Zerahiah his son, Merioth his son, Amariah his son, Ahitub his son, Zadok his son, and Ahimaaz his son. There were 12 high priests from the Exodus to the exile, 12 high priests over a period of 900 years. Now chapter 6 ends with a list of 48 Levitical cities. You remember, the Levites were the one tribe that were not given a territory. The Lord, not the land, was to be their inheritance. They didn't have a parcel. They had a person who they were to be connected to and in love with. They were to be in love with the Lord. And so the Levites, not having a tribal territory of their own, they were given certain cities to live in, scattered throughout the other 12 tribes, 48 of these Levitical cities. Notice 1 Chronicles chapter 6. Notice 1 Chronicles chapter 6. Notice how many verses it has. It has 81 verses. Just for fun, can you name for me the two other chapters in the Bible that have more verses than 81? Can you name one? Psalm 119, that's easy. How many verses does it have? 176 verses. You guys are so smart. Can you tell me the other chapter of the Bible that has more verses than 1 Chronicles chapter 6? 1 Chronicles 6 has 81 verses. Can you name me the other chapter that has more verses than 1 Chronicles 6? Numbers chapter 7 has 89 verses. And so, again, you'll be a big hit at the next trivia night. You got the top three chapters with the most verses. Chapter 7, verses 1 through 5, lists the genealogy of Issachar. Verses 6 through 12, the tribe of Benjamin. Verse 13, the tribe of Naphtali. Verses 14 through 19, the half-tribe of Manasseh that settled on the west bank of the Jordan. Verses 20 through 29, the tribe of Ephraim. And notice verse 27 mentions one of the sons of Ephraim, a man by the name of Joshua, the other faithful spy along with Caleb. Verses 30 through 40 list the final tribe, the sons of Asher. And the two tribes whose genealogies are missing for some reason are Zebulun and Dan. And I'll let you try to figure out why those two tribes are missing their genealogies here. Chapter 8 is a more exhaustive listing of the genealogy of the tribe of Benjamin. King Saul, remember, was Israel's first king. He was a Benjamite. And so chapter 8 is really Saul's genealogy. Saul's father, Kish, had four, and his four sons. Saul's father was Kish, and then Saul had four sons, Jonathan, Malchishua, Abinadab, and Ithbal. They're mentioned in verse 33. Now this Ithbal goes by another name. Anybody know? Ishbosheth was the other name. And you'll recall that after Saul died, Ishbosheth ruled over the northern 10 tribes for a brief period of time until David finally took over and consolidated the kingdom. But this Ithbal was also Ishbosheth. Chapter 9 begins. So all Israel was recorded by genealogies. And indeed, they were inscribed in the book of the kings of Israel. But Judah was carried away captive to Babylon because of their unfaithfulness. And the first inhabitants who dwelt in their possessions, in their cities, were Israel, the Israelites, the priests, the Levites, and the Nethinim. Now, the Nethinim were servants who worked in the temple, but who were not Levites or priests. They were sort of like Adrian. They were summer interns. You know, they weren't Levites, they weren't priests. They were just guys that we kind of recruited to help out, you know, for the summertime or something. So that's what the Nethinim were. Now, between verses 1 and 2, there's a time lapse of 70 years. It's interesting, Ezra skips over Judah's time in Babylon and focuses on the first Jews to return to Judah. His focus is not the time in Babylon. That was a time of judgment, a time of punishment. He wants them to start over again. And so he wants to begin where they begin, in the land, rebuilding the kingdom. Understand, Judah was deported to Babylon in three waves, and they returned from Babylon in three waves. The first return was led by a man named Zerubbabel. And his goal was the rebuilding of the temple. The second return was led by Ezra, the writer of the Chronicles. And Ezra's desire was the rebuilding of the people. Ezra was a priest. He had a heart for the people. So he wanted to rebuild the people. The third wave was led by Nehemiah, who rebuilt the walls. And so remember that, the three waves, the three returns back to Judah, Zerubbabel and the temple, Ezra and the people, and Nehemiah and the walls. Chapter 9 describes those who came back to Judah with Zerubbabel. Verse 3. Now in Jerusalem, the children of Judah dwelt, and some of the children of Benjamin and of the children of Ephraim and Manasseh. And he provides a list of names. He says 956 people settled in Jerusalem. A large contingent of priests also returned. Verse 13 gives us a total and a description. 1,760, and they were very able men for the work of the service of the house of God. The temple was still in rubble, but these were pioneering priests. These were guys that were ready to serve. These were guys who came back to Jerusalem with their shirt sleeves rolled up. Oh, how we need these kind of people in the church today. People that are ready to work. People that are not afraid. Who are able people for the work of the service of the house of God. The house of God is still in need of these kind of people. And then verses 14 through 16 list the names of the Levites who returned. And then verse 17 lists the gatekeepers. And notice it says, Shalom was the chief. Now the gatekeepers were like the ushers. Okay, now this is a word to the ushers right here. The gatekeepers were the ushers, and evidently Shalom was the lead usher. Let's read, begin reading in verse 18. Until then, they had been gatekeepers for the camps of the children of Levi at the king's gate on the east. Shalom, the son of Kori, the son of Ibbasaph, the son of Korah and his brethren, from his father's house, the Korahites, were in charge of the work of the service, gatekeepers of the tabernacle. Their fathers had been keepers of the entrance to the camp of the Lord. And Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, had been the officer over them in time past. The Lord was with him. Zechariah, the son of Meshelemiah, was keeper of the door of the tabernacle of meeting. All those chosen as gatekeepers were 212. Not many, really, for the various gates throughout the temple. They were recorded by their genealogy in their villages. David and Samuel the seer had appointed them to their trusted office. So they and their children were in charge of the gates of the house of the Lord, the house of the tabernacle, by assignment. The gatekeepers were assigned to the four directions, the east, west, north, and south. And their brethren in their villages had come with them from time to time for 7 days. For in this trusted office were four chief gatekeepers. They were Levites. And they had charge over the chambers and treasuries of the house of God. And they lodged all around the house of God because they had the responsibility. And they were in charge of opening it every morning. 1 Chronicles chapter 9, verses 17 to 27, Ezra discusses the ministry of the temple gatekeepers. And again, ushers and greeters are the modern day version of the gatekeepers. If you're an usher or if you're a greeter here at Calvary Chapel, you play a vital role. For you pave the way. You prime the pump for folks when they enter our church to worship God. This is no small responsibility. You are their first impression. Gatekeepers were also troubleshooters. They anticipated needs, and they dealt with any distractions before the interference upset someone in the worship. They made sure that the flow of worshipers moved smoothly in and out of the temple. There were many functions for these gatekeepers or these temple ushers. Notice also they were in charge over the chambers and treasuries of the house of God. They made sure nobody ran off with the offering box. Major responsibilities. Now I want you to notice 6 points about the gatekeepers that also apply to being an usher. First, it was a needed position. You can write that down. A needed position. Thousands of worshipers would come to the temple daily. During the feast, the numbers swelled to hundreds of thousands. And there were numerous gates. Folks came from various angles. There was much to oversee. This was a needed position. Second, I want you to notice, this was a coordinated position. Notice verse 17 tells us that they had a chief named Shalom. Verse 23 says that their tasks were carried out by assignment. In other words, they had a schedule that they kept. Everybody was on the schedule. Verse 24 indicates they were assigned a specific direction to cover. East, west, north, and south. Sanctuary, foyer, children's ministry, playground. And they were organized for ministry. Hey, this was a coordinated position. Notice the third thing. This was an important position. Both verses 22 and 26 called the role of an usher a trusted office. Gatekeepers represented God. People were coming into God's house, and you're his host. Do you realize that, guys, if you're an usher? You're God's host. You're hosting people into his house to worship him. This is a trusted office. This is a sacred trust. Verse 21 calls the gatekeeper the keeper of the door. That's a heavy role to play in God's house. That means you control who gets in and who gets out. The keeper of the door. You got into the temple through the usher, you were escorted out of the temple by the gatekeeper. And the same is true here at Calvary Chapel. Get rowdy, start heckling the pastor, create too great a disturbance in the worship, and the church ushers will show you the door. Notice fourth, this was an honored position. A needed position, a coordinated position, an important position, and an honored position. Notice verse 19 says the gatekeepers were part of a heritage. They were following in their father's footsteps. You know, being a gatekeeper was like going to the same college as your dad and your granddad and your great-granddad. It was sort of part of a legacy you were carrying on. These guys grew up looking for, oh, one day I'm going to get to be an usher at Calvary Chapel. One day it's going to be my turn. One day I'm going to be a gatekeeper. They were excited about it. They grew up looking forward to this privilege. And then fifth, it's a responsible position. Notice verse 26. They had charge, which means they were given authority to make decisions. Verse 27 tells us it was their duty to open up the temple every morning. In other words, the worship of God started on their cue. Can you imagine a heavier responsibility? And notice too, they lodged all around the house of God because they had the responsibility. The obligation that the gatekeepers felt toward their ministry was so strong that they even moved in from outlying areas. And they moved their families in around the temple so they would be there. They could live nearby to take care of their duties and their responsibilities. Notice sixth, it was a spiritual position. And if you go back and look in verse 20, it mentions Phinehas, evidently the first leader of this order. And here's what it was said of him. The Lord was with him. And you know, guys, to be a good gatekeeper, to be a good usher, you have to be empowered by the Lord. You need the joy and the discernment and the patience and the firmness and the love of the Lord. Gatekeepers need to be led and controlled by the Spirit of God. Now, those of you who are an usher or a greeter here at Calvary Chapel, understand you have joined the ranks of the ancient gatekeepers. And so I'm here tonight to admonish you to live up to their high standards. I'll never forget the event that forever upped the ante on what it means to be an usher at Calvary Chapel. So those of you guys that are ushers, you know, we joke with you sometimes, we laugh with you sometimes, but you know what? Your job is vitally important, and you are following men like John Calmer, who took it seriously and who held it in high esteem. And God, you're God's host. You're a host for God in his family and in his house. What more honored position could you have? Verse 28. Now some of them were in charge of the serving vessels, for they brought them in and took them out by count. In other words, some of these guys handled the communion trays, you know, whenever the church had communion, the serving vessels. And some of the gatekeepers were appointed over the furnishings and over all the implements of the sanctuary. In other words, they moved chairs. And they brought in the big ladder whenever one of the stage light bulbs blew, you know, they took care of moving the furniture and all around and so forth. And over the fine flour and over the wine and over the oil and over the incense and over the spices. And some of the sons of the priests were made the ointment of the spices. In other words, the gatekeeper's job was to change out the deodorizers in the restrooms, the spices. Now, Mattathiah of the Levites, the firstborn of Shalom, the Korahite, had the trusted office over the things that were baked in the pans. Verse 32. And some of their brethren of the sons of the Kohathites were in charge of preparing the showbread for every Sabbath. These are the singers, heads of the fathers' houses of the Levites, who lodged in the chambers and were free from other duties, for they were employed in that work day and night. What a great situation. These musicians on the payroll to do nothing but to sing praise to God. The temple was always filled with wonderful praise. Now the rest of chapter 9, verses 35 through 44, once more recounts Saul's family tree. The death of Israel's first king is the topic of chapter 10. Now the Philistines fought against Israel. And the men of Israel fled from before the Philistines and fell slain on Mount Gilboa. Then the Philistines followed hard after Saul and his sons. And the Philistines killed Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua, Saul's sons. The battle became fierce against Saul. The archers hit him, and he was wounded by the archers. Then Saul said to his armor bearer, "Draw your sword and thrust me through with it, lest these uncircumcised men come and abuse me." He was afraid that his longtime nemesis, the Philistines, would torture him like they tortured Samson if they caught him alive. You remember what they did to Samson? They plucked out his eyes with a hot poker. And Saul wants his armor bearer, his personal bodyguard, to just go ahead and kill him. But his armor bearer would not, for he was greatly afraid. I mean, by this point, Saul is a pathetic figure, but he's still king over Israel. Therefore, Saul took a sword and he fell on it. And when his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell on his sword and died. And so Saul and his three sons died, and all his house died together. Now, 1 Samuel chapter 1 indicates that Saul's suicide attempt may have failed, and that his death may have been hastened by an Amalekite who happened by at this particular time. You can go back and put these two events together, the account here in 2 Samuel chapter 1. And when all the men of Israel who were in the valley saw that they had fled and that Saul and his sons were dead, they forsook their cities and fled. And then the Philistines came and dwelt in them. And this, of course, was the low point for the nation Israel. And so it happened the next day when the Philistines came to strip the slain that they found Saul and his sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. You know, pouchers have now come out and they're going to take away the gold and take their watches off and clean out their wallets and, you know, just kind of rip off all of the corpses lying on the battlefield. And they found Saul and his sons and they stripped him and they took his head and his armor. And they sent word throughout all the land of the Philistines to proclaim the news in the temple of their idols and among the people. And then they put his armor in the temple of their gods and fastened his head in the temple of Dagon. And they did this to mock not only the king of Israel, but also to mock his God. 1 Samuel 31 tells us that the Philistines also nailed the body of Saul to the wall in Bethshan. And some of you who've been to Israel with us have been to Bethshan. This was where Saul's corpse was literally nailed to the wall. Now, verse 11 tells us. And when all Jabesh-Gilead heard all that the Philistines had done to Saul, all the valiant men arose and took the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons, and they brought them to Jabesh and buried their bones under the tamarisk tree at Jabesh and fasted 7 days. And so out of respect for a king of Israel that had fallen, these men of Jabesh-Gilead, they invaded Bethshan and they took back Saul's body so that they could give him a decent burial. Verse 13. So Saul died for his unfaithfulness, which he had committed against the Lord, because he did not keep the word of the Lord, and also because he consulted a medium for guidance. But he did not inquire of the Lord. Therefore he killed him and turned the kingdom over to David, the son of Jesse. Notice it wasn't the Philistines that killed Saul. God killed Saul because Saul had been unfaithful to God. He had failed to seek the Lord. He instead had consulted with witches. Saul died because of his disobedience to God. Make no mistake about it, Saul died at the hand of God.